Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you.
So, Gruß aus Berlin heute. Here we are in Berlin for Super Returns, and it's incredibly exciting, and there's a lot of people, but fortunately, the senior citizens have gathered here to be able to have a conversation that I hope is really interesting, because in a world where private equity and private debt are on the lips of allocators and others, there are few people who have a long history in specializing in all types of credit. So, I have in front of me what a gentleman who describes himself as an accidental investor, which we're going to come to, but Victor Kozler, who is the founder of Strategic Value Partners, is here today at the conference, and we're going to have a conversation that I think is going to cover lots of different areas. So, Victor, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Simon.
It's a pleasure. Well, we discovered, not having met before, that we were both at Citibank for a time. You were born in India, but you described yourself as this accidental investor. I need you to unravel that.
So I went to business school in the States, and I worked in this strategy consulting firm for 4 years. Citibank hired me to work in planning, to be chief of staff. And I ended up writing a business plan for Citi to start a business in distressed debt. Planning guy, writing that business plan. And afterwards I said, hey, how about me? Why don't I kind of work on it? And they said, why not you? It's 1991. And all of a sudden, the business of trading in bank loans, trading in distressed debt, it's just starting. And I'm 33 years old. I have never bought or sold a bond or a piece of debt in my life. And I am suddenly buying and selling debt.
And, you know, there's that lovely line, opening line to the go-between, which is the past is a foreign country. Yeah. They do things differently there. Bank trading reflected the fact that the loan business was a bank business. It hadn't been disintermediated. So we're going to talk about that. But just set the scene, how much of the expression the Wild West was applicable to the Citibank trading room back then?
Yeah. You know, anytime you're in a business which is just starting, the rules and the structures are just being set up. So, like at a very basic level, when you buy or sell something, you need to know that you're done. You have bought it or sold it. When we started trading, investing in bank loans in distressed debt, it was subject to a document. Deals used to break. Deals almost never break now. But in the early years, after you did a deal, you weren't quite 100% sure it was actually going to settle, right? That is setting up the rules, setting up those processes. The business just took off. There was a need. Banks, there were leverage buyouts which had been done. They had gone bad. There was a need for banks to want liquidity because these were non-performing loans. And to essentially accommodate that need for liquidity, there is a business which got set up. And 1991, Bloomingdale's, Macy's, first deals. That was the beginning of this modern market in secondary and discounted and distressed debt.
We put some numbers on it today. There, I think I'm right in saying it's a $5 trillion high-yield market today.
It is, globally. Yeah.
It's an $8 trillion mortgage debt market.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, a lot of this debt is coming due. But before we get there into your firm, just explain, was it the great financial crisis or was it the long period of zero rates, possibly misguided, that really turbocharged the world that is now private debt?
The business itself, the leverage buyout business, literally took off in the 90s. When you do leverage buyouts, not everything works all the time. Things go bad. When things go bad, you can't just go out and say, I bought debt at 60 cents. You need to restructure a balance sheet. You need to reduce the amount of debt. You need to often fix businesses operationally. It's not just the capital structure which has to be done. So there is an industry which grew up around all these deals which had gone bad with too much leverage, with management teams which often weren't quite equipped for kind of what the job was. The private equity business grew by leaps and bounds. The high yield business grew. And by the way, interestingly, this was a very US business. In early 2002, 2003, Europe joined the party. European leverage buyouts really took off. So the business, instead of being US, became a US-Europe business. So that evolution, and by the way, the skills to do this, always in short supply. And it's not just the financial restructuring skills, it's also the operational skills, right? All those skills in short supply, but with larger and larger amounts of debt, which needed to be kind of reworked, this business has just kind of exploded and taken off.
And we were very lucky. We had Mike Milken on as a guest towards the end of last year, who was, of course, the architect of this extraordinary venture. So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. So you've had several postings along the way before you create your business. You're a service. You were also at Moore Capital, and most people will know that Lewis Bacon was revered as an investor. Was there something that you particularly learned there that stayed with you?
Risk management. Look, I got to know Lewis a little bit, but Lewis is, and he would blush if he heard me say this, right? He was one of the hardest working guys at Moore. And the way he thought about risk and how he managed risk, right? I always thought, just one more thought about Moore and Lewis. The infrastructure, not just the investment stuff, the back office, the infrastructure. What Lewis built at Moore, boy, I took lessons from that, right, over all these different kind of years. So, yeah, learned. My stint was all of 2.5 years long, but learned a lot from it.
So at 01, you set up SVP, Strategic Value Partners. Was there just this burning entrepreneurial desire to do something on your own?
Yes. And there was $100 million from Moore Capital, which made it easy.
Okay.
Right. And by the way, in 2001, $100 million was real money.
Proper money, yeah.
Right. It is real money. Right. Look, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Right. I was in my early 40s, experienced, been in the markets, been investing. It was the right time for me to take that kind of risk. And having $100 million kind of made it easier. As we first started Strategic Value Partners. our business. Would it help, Simon, if I describe the
journey? I was going to say, 25 years on, tell us where you are.
So fast forward to today. We have $18 billion of assets under management. We have 200 or so people working in the firm with 100 or so investment professionals. But if I could take you a little through that journey, our roots are in distressed debt and restructurings. That's where we started in 2001, as we started to kind of build SVP. But what we found was the distress business, the restructuring business, is a really interesting business 2 years out of 10. It's not like every year there's a dislocation, right? So there is a fat part of the cycle, and then there's still stuff to do, but it tapers off. So for us, the journey we've been on is we have built out, we have developed a firm over these last 23 years, which is so much broader with so many different skills running through it. So just so you kind of get a sense, the distress business, restructuring business, buying debt at 50 cents, buying debt at 60 cents, 2 years out of 10, we started to build control skills. We found that in our business, a lot of companies which get troubled, a lot of these kind of businesses, there's a lot of operational upside. It's not just kind of fixing the capital structure, but to go get that low-hanging fruit, your investment teams need to be more like private equity teams, and you need operating partners, right? It's not just a financial paper trading, paper investing business. So starting in 2008, we started to build out those operational skills. Today, we have 20 people, employees of the firm, who are operating partners. Some of them are really seasoned. We have a larger, I would say, more muscular team than a lot of $50 billion plus private equity funds. The other thing we did, and there are a few other, we also did some other things. Right from the get-go, we were a US-Europe firm. Europe was just starting, and what we found was, and you know, I've been investing in Europe since the mid-90s, including my times on Wall Street. So Europe, we found, was just growing. It is much more inefficient than the United States. Fewer people here, fewer competitors. Everything is a little more opaque. The US markets are a little more transparent. For us, we like a little bit more opaque, right? It just gets to better bargains if you can do your job well, right? So we, right from the get-go, we became a US-Europe firm, not 55% US, 45% Europe. And then the other thing we did, we're not just a corporate investment house. We found that real assets, infrastructure, toll roads, power generation plants, airplanes, real estate, there is a lot of debt in all these asset classes which needs to be reworked. So we became 60% a corporate firm, 40% real assets. So you pull it all kind of together, Simon, we are no longer a cyclical boom-bust credit investor. Like most people.
Right.
We are evergreen. We can invest because when you can do distressed debt and then do control, you can do US, Europe. Europe is the gift which keeps on giving for us. Okay. You can do corporate and real assets. We become an evergreen firm where vintage for us almost doesn't matter.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is now sponsored by the World Gold Council. Gold has been at the foundation of human civilizations and economic history, from the pharaohs of ancient Egypt to James Bond. Through to its vital role in central bank reserves, gold has come to symbolize trade, culture, and currency. Discover the transformational powers of gold by watching Idris Elba's film on an adventure that explores gold's meaning and contribution to societies and economies the world over. Visit journey.gold on your browser to learn more.
Now, you are unusual because most people get into this space having grown up through the pure investment route. Yeah. You came as a strategy consultancy, a management consultancy bent. But, of course, you talk about Europe, and we're going to just dig a little bit deeper. But Europe still, would it be fair to say today, is much more dependent on bank lending than the US.
It is, yes.
How might that whole landscape evolve? Because one of the arguments that we've heard from Xavier Rolli onwards is one of Europe's Achilles heels is the lack of equity financing. And until that changes, you're not going to get as much entrepreneurial energy and activity.
Can I take it a little broader even, right? So when you look at Europe through our eyes, Europe has relatively frequent crises. US is like Fortress America. In Europe, every 2 years, there are issues. You know, whether it is the Greek crisis, Brexit, do the Italians have too much debt? The Ukraine war is really tough all around. It has a makes a real difference in Europe. America, economically, it's tough, it's painful, but economically, America doesn't really feel it, right? Just what it is. So Europe is, it's large, it's inefficient, with frequent sort of crises. So the way somebody like us approaches it, you want to be here because opportunistically it will provide you a relatively steady diet of opportunities, unlike the United States, which will tend to be a little more cyclical.
Yep, I heard that from Tigerhau Capital. We have Mathieu Chabrin on recently and others. Yeah. And it's that intriguing, shall I say, disconnect at a macro level from the micro level because of Eurosclerosis. I want to just talk about today's climate for debt investors and debt.
Can I go back to Europe just to kind of finish a thought, right? So you get these frequent bumps and frequent opportunities. Europe has very few people with the sort of skills we do to be able to source these deals from the banks and the CLOs to be much more than just the financial investor, to be able to either manage the asset, the airplane, the real estate, or to manage the company. Those, in not just one skill, but that grouping of skills altogether, very, very few people in Europe with those kind of skills. And that is what has created this frequent source of opportunities for somebody like us.
I get it. So we look today, and as I travel around, my investment nose and ear tells me and reinforces that with a private equity backlog and logjam of deals that haven't happened, there is quite a lot of loan restructuring and discussions happening. Yeah. And if I knew nothing, I would go, let me look at what's going on in the high yield indices. Yeah. They will show some signs of stress.
None.
There is none. Help me understand that disconnect.
The world, if you just look at the headlines, seems very serene. By the way, and it is solid economically. You know, after the Fed hikes, the ECB rate hikes, the economy is starting to kind of come around. It's slow. Europe has really suffered last year. And even in the Q1 GDP numbers, you can see a little pickup in economic activity. So on the face of it, economically, not quite as good as the headlines. If you take out the big seven tech stocks, S&P doesn't look that good. It looks okay. Right? So not as good as the headlines. But at the same time, solid. Now, against this, to the point I think you're making, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is all those pesky historical portfolios. I think what most people are going to be investing in today, over the next couple of years, then fresh capital, it's all going to be, I think these are going to be good vintages, just where we are. But the historical portfolios, private equity has $5 trillion invested in 26,000 companies. I think you said it well. There's $5 trillion of high yield. There's $8 trillion of mortgage debt. And all this was done when interest rates were zero. Most of it was done in zero rates. So today, interest rates are higher. At the same time, you have maturities coming. In our view, $2 trillion of that $5 trillion is going to mature in high yield over the next 3+ years. Larger numbers in commercial mortgage debt. And what that is creating, please, there's no crash because economically we are in a better place, but it's a slog. It's a slog to rework, to refinance. And by the way, there's a lot of refinancing's going on, and private equity in some ways on some of these deals is saying, had enough. But please, don't get the wrong idea. Our base case is no crash. It's a slog as we kind of work through this over the next
years. I know that, and I know your euphemisms about adventurous credits and restructurings, but there's a lot of stuff that could converge to make it very ugly.
Yeah.
But that's my macro opinion. It's going to be no better or worse than possibly quite worse than others. However, as I think about what you've just said, would I be right in saying that there will be a lot of current investors in funds that had expectations of returns that are not going to be realized?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of investors who might now be going, what an interesting time to allocate assets to the restructuring space. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. The sheen, you know, today when you look at the direct lending businesses, we think once you look back a year from now, 2 years from now, the sheen will have come off some as we kind of work through this historical portfolio.
Right.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. Schroders is a $950 billion public-private global asset management business. Built to deliver long-term client value, Schroders focuses their business on growing into areas where there is greater demand, private markets, bespoke solutions, and wealth management, and where they can better serve clients. Schroders take a long-term perspective and a leadership position in sustainability. With a 220-year history of successful adaptation and innovation, Schroders have always focused on serving clients. Remember, capital is at risk with investing.
So, here we are, as we said, in Berlin, in Europe, and I looked at your investments, and I know you're one of the largest car park owners in Europe. You also own Swissport. Any of us who travel through European airports, the largest baggage handler in the world or in Europe, how did that come about?
Swissport is the largest baggage handling company in the world, right? And we bought into this investment right after COVID. So Swissport, you know, baggage aviation travel, it just kind of dropped, obviously, with just what happened with COVID. By the way, this baggage handling business, extraordinary long-term business. Swissport is 2.5 times the size of its nearest competitor. Travel grows at 4-5% a year over 50 years, barring COVID. So just an extraordinary business what it was, but COVID was tough. Swissport was leveraged pre-COVID. So in COVID, it essentially went through a restructuring. And we ended up buying debt.
And let me just ask, did the equity holders get wiped out?
They did. Mostly.
Okay.
They mostly got wiped out.
Got it.
The senior debt holders, and there was $1.5 billion of senior debt, ended up through a debt equity restructuring, taking control of the business. And for us, Simon, we ended up buying a lot of debt. Our average price was 65, 70 cents a face, right? And through that debt, it was in the UK, there's something called a scheme of arrangements. That scheme is much more efficient than Chapter 11 in the US.
Is that right?
3 months. In 3 months, the debt got converted into equity. And by the way, today, we own almost half the equity of Swissport. But the interesting part for us, the journey just began by buying the debt, converting it into equity, right?
Got it.
Because when we took over this business, it had 13,000 employees. Today, it has 60,000 plus employees. And can I tell you, that ride up, it wasn't so smooth. By the way, the company is doing well now. We just did a refinancing a month ago. The company is in really good, strong shape. But over the years, because, you know, you've had inflation, lots of inflation, you've had to pass it through. So it wasn't as smooth as kind of the numbers.
Right.
We had our moments, right?
But I can see why it should be, could be an annuity business.
Yeah.
Who owned it before?
It was a Chinese business who had bought Swissport.
Out of Swiss Air originally? Okay.
Yeah.
So there you have a business. Now, typically, funds in your universe have a shelf life.
Yeah.
And there comes then to the fund to be wound up.
Yeah.
This is a business, it seems to me, knowing very little, it could be quite attractive to them for a very long time because of those inflation-linked dynamics and tourism growing. What happens? Is this a classic at the expiry, it then gets moved into another fund? What happens?
When you're in the private equity business, you're not in the 1-2 year investment business, but you are in the 3-5 year investment business, right?
Yeah.
Is there a possibility of moving something on some deals? Maybe. But the base case has to be, it is, look, we're in the 3-5 year investment business. And you know, when we think about kind of Swissport, we believe we've been a good steward. We believe we've done we are doing, by the way, just a really strong management team installed, right? A brand new chairman, a new CEO, a new CFO, and they have really worked with us to kind of drive this transformation, right? But, you know, we want to set it up for the next owner, for us to be able to get the right kind of monetization. You know, for us, we want to set it up for kind of the next owner to kind of do well. And I want to go back to Swissport with one more thing.
Okay.
Right? The number, you know, we were describing about franchise. The number of people in this world today who know how to buy debt piece by piece to accumulate a controlling stake, that's not so easy. Restructuring a balance sheet, quite a few people know how to do it. But to marry that buying of debt with the operational skills to be able to go help fix, help improve the business, the combination of those skills is very distinct. I don't want to use the word unique, but I almost want to.
Thank you. You must have known that it's a word I hate because of its overuse.
Right.
So I'm with you.
It's a special, unusual. And it's our ability to be able to pull that together, right? Which is kind of what makes something like a Swissport happen.
Let me ask you a final hypothetical question.
Yeah.
Ultimately, should an asset like that sit in an infrastructure fund?
Absolutely. It should sit in a sovereign fund. It should sit in an infrastructure fund. It's one of those, you know, I think it's overused when people say, hey, there are some forever assets. This is a forever asset.
Well, IFM Australia are one of the sponsors of the Money Mates podcast, and they are the great experts on infrastructure. So if you don't know them, we'll make sure that you do know them.
Oh, now, wait. We know them.
I'm sure you do. I mentioned that you were also a big car park owner. I mean, again, because for many, the private debt and private equity world seems apart, and yet actually these are fundamental parts of daily life.
Yeah.
How do you get into the parking business?
You know, we are an old economy value investor. We are not a software, not a tech investor, right? We have a really good sense of what we are good at, right? What our focus is. We have been very large investors in infrastructure over the last 10 years. So core infrastructure is toll roads. We own a toll road in Portugal today. We own a toll road in Texas today. We bought a waste-to-energy business in the UK called Corey. You see those boats on the Thames going to Riverside where it's burnt?
Yeah.
We used to own Corey.
Okay.
We helped fix it, turn it around, and we sold it. Swissport, the car parking business, we are just buying a ferry business, the Statue of Liberty, the Niagara Falls Ferry in the United States, again through a restructuring. Infrastructure for us, whether it's core or whether it is some of this other infrastructure, just being a place of real focus. And the car parking business you're describing just kind of fits up.
So you're excited about the restructuring. You have these other businesses covering lots of areas. We've talked about Europe and US. Is there anything going on in the rest of the world, including your native country, India, that gets your attention? Or have you got just enough on your plates in those geographies?
You know, we want to operate in business in countries with a true rule of law.
Yeah, yeah.
And we want to operate in companies where in the 30-40% of our portfolio, we are controlling a business. We can make the operational changes, right, which we want to try and do. When we look at, and please, I'm Indian, so I can say this quite like this, but when we look at a lot of emerging markets, it's really hard to have all those things kind of work.
Yep.
We know our limitations. So when you see us, we are really a U.S., Europe firm. Every now and then, we'll do stuff in Japan. I lived in Tokyo for a few years. We like Japan as a place to do business, but it's not a steady diet of deals. But I think that's very much our world. We're not going to get into much.
And actually, it's timely because a few days ago, I interviewed Rob Arnott of Research Affiliates, the value specialist. And as he says, one of the glaring investment opportunities is equity, listed equity in the emerging markets, which is another completely different asset class. Okay. So, Victor, we're moving towards a conclusion. I've really been very, very illuminated. I've been illuminated by how you described your business. Some interesting future returns right now on the ground. Mm. How you think about the list of priorities for you as a business and for you advising investors?
Look, you heard me describe the 800-pound gorilla in the room, right? The fact that it creates the need for adventurous financing for restructurings. This is happening now. Right now, what I'm describing is not like, hey, it's next year or the year after. We have $18 billion in assets under management, Simon. We invested $3.5 billion in 2023. This is not like, oh, yeah, this is going to come. No, no. It's right now. It's happening right now, which is the opportunity.
Well, Victor, I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah.
You have a fascinating business. You called yourself the accidental investor. And then I thought, well, hang on a second. None of us were born thinking we were going to be investors. Maybe we are all accidental investors.
I do hear of some fund managers saying, I was an investor when I was 12 years old. Yeah, that wasn't me.
I think that's quite worrying. I have interviewed some people who said, I've always dreamt about being an investment business. And it's like, well, I think you need to go and travel the world, son, before you think about that. Yeah. Good luck with your mission, and I will be watching and seeing how things unfold. But having the time to you today and Berlin Super Returns has been absolutely great.
Simon, a treat for me. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.